The discussions on this podcast are not intended for diagnosis, treatment, or prescription. All dialogue, conversations, and recommendations are meant for educational purposes only. The only responsible way to optimize your unique plan of care is with the guidance of a trained professional. Always consult your physician before implementing any treatment protocol. Hello and welcome back to another episode of our Cellular Medicine Podcast. I want to say, hey, thank you for hanging in there and understanding that, you know, we haven't been the most fluent in staying up to date with some of our podcasts, and I will just really refer you to the fact that we are in an incredible state of expansion, and it's just, we're just so blessed to be moving forward on so many fronts in the SSRP and our Redox Medical Group that we're bringing, I think, a better product to you now, something that will be more consistent, more informative. So behind the scenes, we've been actually working on coming back and coming back strong, because that's, you know, I have to say that's what we're all about at the SSRP. It's not about how good are we doing. It's how can we do this better, and how can we make this a better experience for you? And I'm going to tell you, in listening to my team, I really have to really develop a better humility aspect in my life, because they really know how to come at me and say, hey, doc, you got to change this. You got to do better at this. And it's, I'm not used to hearing that, to be honest. So I'm working on my skills and trying to do a better job of explaining things to you. So please, you know, love to hear your feedback. We're just so humbled and excited to be able to be right in front of you now. So thanks for joining us. I'm extremely excited about where this is going, and I can't tell you, other than the passion I have here is even at a higher level to make a better product for you and do a better job of informing you. And that's what we're all about here at the SSRP. So let's get going and let's see where this takes us. First question from the forum. I have an 81-year-old male with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, congestive heart failure, atrial fibrillation on Eliquis. He's a very sharp-minded person, but overall has become increasingly more frail. What peptides would you start with? And he cannot work out, and cardiology took him off testosterone years ago. Also, if I add thymus and alpha 1, do I have to worry about him flaring his COPD? So I think this question, actually, there's a lot we can think about and correlate into. I'm going to try to give you an answer that has many different implications in helping an elderly patient, number one, a frail patient that is actually inactive, that is more than likely sarcopenic, that is obviously having problems with oxygen because of the COPD and the atrial fib and some congestive heart failure. So there's a lot here that I think we can really bring into play in helping not just an individual with all these multiple comorbidities, but it'll help us kind of think through the process of what is the initiating root cause that's led to all of these issues. And I'm going to say right off the bat, we're looking at a metabolism issue with the mitochondria, and the loss of efficiency, the loss of flexibility of the mitochondria to utilize glucose, fatty acids, and proteins in the right fashion that leads to this efficiency we're looking for. So let's just kind of take it through the steps. You talked about number one. Let me just get right to the immune modulator, thymus and alpha 1. I think that's an excellent thought. I think it's a great way potentially to start, because we know in the literature, like with a patient like this, and especially with COPD or more of these significant lung diseases, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis and so forth, or primary pulmonary hypertension, that there is a great deal of cellular senescence that is present. And cellular senescence, remember, a senescent cell is one of those cells that builds up over time, that's a bad cell, that it's like a zombie cell that we can't get rid of, or becomes difficult for the immune system to remove, and it has such a big play in producing those cytokines, chemokines, proteases that induce that inflammatory state, that change metabolism, that affect the immune system, that weaken people over time. And we know with aging that this is a significant factor. Senescence is all about aging. But in significant diseases and disease states like this, plus the congestive heart failure, we know senescence plays a very significant role. So TA1 is actually, you know, for taking a stab at this question, that's a brilliant start. And the reason I say that is because we know that thymosin alpha-1 has an effect it has a senolytic effect. It's not a senomodulator, it's a senolytic, meaning it's going to enable the immune system to recognize more of these senescent cells and help in removing them. And, you know, I could go down each one of these areas in great detail, but that's the essence to start with. Is I think TA1 is a brilliant start, and actually, as I go through this question, I think what's important is I like taking baby steps, and I don't like throwing multiple peptide supplements, repurposed drugs at someone to take care of a specific problem. I like to start out slowly. And I do like working on, so you have to look at this as metabolism, immunity, and also microbiome. And so it's like, where do you start in this process of helping this patient? And I do think that the immune system is very important, because it's immunometabolism is where we spend a lot of time. Our group in how this has such an influence in disease processes and aging. So TA1 would be an excellent start in just not helping the senescence aspects, but also working on immune modulation, because these people are absolutely more susceptible to acute viral and bacterial infections, and you're going to help these patients in modulating their immune system to be more active with more Treg cells, more natural killer cells, more things to be adaptive, or more things to be prepared for the innate immune system to work better, but also the adaptive immune system, because they're modulators. Don't get caught up with TA1 being just working on one side of the immune system. It doesn't work that way. It's a modulator. It works on the innate and the adaptive immune system. So that being said, I think that gives you a clear picture of, yes, TA1 is an excellent start. And I kind of look at it as a base in working on my foundation. I think building a foundation and making incremental changes is just crucial for the patient. It's crucial to make further judgments, because you're not only using this as a therapeutic, you're using it as a diagnostic tool to make sure you're on the right path. And in my experience with the COPD or idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis or primary pulmonary hypertension, all these issues that have significant influences on the lungs, and we'll get into the heart issues. I think I'm always able to make some improvement to some degree. So that's where I would start, and there are numerous ways to do that. I typically will start out with a small dose of TA1, anywhere from 15 to 20 IUs as a testing dose for a week or so on a daily routine to see how the patient adjusts to that. And then I go to a 50 IU dosing of where I'll do that for 2 weeks straight. And then, based on how they're progressing, I'll change that. So I think that's a very foundational place to start. It's an easy start, and you're not going to flare up the COPD. In fact, you're going to work on improving it. So that's the immune side of this, and we could go into many other areas here, but the immune side is very important. I think you also have to be thinking ahead of the issues with fibrosis that the senescence brings, that these disease states bring in not only the lungs but the heart. And this fibrosis, TA1 is an antifibritic. It works against this production of fibrosis by these senescent fibroblasts and by other senescent cells. So you're working in that area also with this TA1, which is just incredible. So you've got all these pleiotropic pathway or effects that TA1 can have in the initiation of treating this patient. The next thing I think you have to then focus on is, okay, let's really look at metabolism, because this is a frail patient, congestive heart failure, not getting enough oxygen to the cell. We know the mitochondria is affected. We know we're not getting optimal ATP and NAD production. So where can we go in trying to help with metabolism? And this is where I have a true passion in trying to get this message across about a very simple nutritional supplement known as a ketone ester. And I think ketone esters play an incredible role in helping us with getting people off to an amazing start with changing that flexibility of the cell and the mitochondrial aspects of using a substrate like a ketone ester, which is the ultimate food group for the cell, meaning as opposed to a protein, a carbohydrate, or a fatty acid, this ketone ester gets taken into the cell with very little effort, meaning it's not burning up energy to make energy. And it's being utilized immediately in the cardiomyocyte, in multiple lung cells and immune cells in the lung, and also in the brain. So it's got many areas of where it's assisting with metabolism and helping so much with this increase in what we're looking for, that ATP-NAD aspect of and improving the NAD-NADH ratio. This is, I think, just very, very important in, again, using something where you're going to see immediate results within days, if not within the same day, of how the patient is going to tell you how they feel, how they may be breathing better. I mean, it can have profound changes, and that's all about changing nutritional ketosis, right? We're putting them in a nutritional ketosis of utilizing maybe between, if it's a female, 10 mLs versus a male, 15 to 20 mLs of a ketone ester. That'll give you about 3 to 4 hours of a maybe up to 1 millimole ketosis. That is incredible. That's a nutritional ketosis that is improving right off the bat ATP and NAD. So you've got a way to manage immediately some metabolic aspects that remember, once we start improving mitochondrial function, we start improving antioxidant production, we start improving signaling to immune cells for activation of immune cells in assisting with acting against this global senescence. We're doing so many things that are all based off of one thing, a ketone ester. And so that is a great start. Ketone esters are, I have to say, they're a conversation you have to have with the patient, because it's a liquid that can maybe not have the best taste, but it is flavored and you can mix it in water and you can get, we've worked with many patients to try to make this work. You'll get some that it'll be tough, but I'm going to tell you, if you spend the time in working on this and getting that process in play, this ketone ester plays a valuable role for you in helping to get metabolism in play. So you've started with a TA1, you've got this ketone ester that you've started to change metabolism and give the patient some hope and show the patient, hey, look, we can change some of this activity aspect. And I think this is going to be a bigger play for you. And ketone esters, by the way, are very significant now in cardiac research and more specifically congestive heart failure. So you've got something that I think can have a considerable change and lead you into working on improved diets and so forth with these patients. And because they are sarcopenic, they're not eating as much, there's a lot that goes down with that. And I think that's really important, for you to have that as a primary play without doing too much to change diet. So there's something there to grasp, and of course we could talk about all these things for hours. So ketone ester, and you can do that up to 3 times a day. You want to try to do it without food if you can. And it's also an excellent job in improving insulin sensitivity and glucose absorption. And I think that's another thing that's really underestimated about ketone esters. So you've got metabolism, we've talked about the immune system, and then we can talk about looking at some other peptides to help with efficiencies of this metabolism. I think what we need to do is look at what other peptides or supplements or so forth do we have that we can utilize that focus more on improving mitochondrial efficiencies. And I think we should have that discussion about going right to the powerhouse of a GHRH, a growth hormone secretagogue, like a GHRH or GHRP, that have a profound influence on inducing your own endogenous growth hormone production, meaning a physiologic release. And it doesn't matter that the patient's 71, and the fact that the patient's 71, they're probably, statistically, they're producing 30 to 40% of their growth hormone they would have been producing at the age of 30. That's a profound difference, because that growth hormone has a significant influence as a master regulator of the immune system, of metabolism. I mean, it affects thymus. It can assist in the thymus where there's been severe involution with this patient, meaning that's how the immune system's been affected over time with age and then with disease. So it's been shown that growth hormone can improve and increase some activity within the thymus gland. And helping with the immune system in metabolism, the key with growth hormone is taking advantage of what we can do with beta oxidation of fat. And that's the flexibility this patient has lost. That's what they've lost in the heart. They've lost that ability to oxidize fat as a primary substrate. They've lost this in the lungs. They've lost it in the brain. So improving beta oxidation, meaning bringing fatty acids into the mitochondria and converting them to ATP and NADH, is crucial, as opposed to the patient that's probably more glucose focused. Now we're going to take that patient from just primarily a glycolysis process to fully taking advantage of that TCA cycle and oxidative phosphorylation and production of ATP and NAD. So that is, I think, crucial for this patient, where we can, so we've introduced a substrate like a ketone ester, but then we've introduced a peptide that has the potential of improving all of these aspects and also raising a physiologic level of IGF-1, which is important for the brain, is important for repair recovery of the lungs, and stopping fibrosis and working more significantly in the heart, in repair and recovery of the heart. So where do we go with something like that? Well, we could look at using ipamorelin at nighttime, just at a small dose of 2.5 IUs to 5 IUs nightly, which could make a profound difference. And that's a GHRP, and that could be significant. Or we could look at going right to something like tesamorelin and starting off with a lower dose of tesamorelin, like 25 IUs of tesamorelin, as opposed to the normal dosing of 50 IUs or so. And I would start at the lower dosing, and tesamorelin can be used in the morning. It's a more compliant, probably, process for the patient, and they'll get, that's a GHRH, that is a third generation GHRH, which has significant benefits on metabolism. So we've got a solution that works for the heart there, works for the lungs, and can, remember, by improving efficiencies of the mitochondria, we talked about this AFib problem. Atrial fibrillation can absolutely be correlated with the inefficiencies of the mitochondria. And that's another way that you potentially can have unexpected results here. I think something else, and in conjunction with that, that brings me into talking about BPC-157, which I think is another beneficial peptide at this time, because it's a peptide that has significant pathways in recovery and repair. It has been studied in arrhythmias and atrial fibrillation and can have an impact on decreasing that. And it works in conjunction with something like a tesamorelin, because it has that influence in making that tesamorelin work better, because as these patients age, they lose these growth hormone receptors on immune cells and other cells that the BPC-157 can influence these increased receptors of growth hormone receptors. So that's significant. So that can play a role there. And remember that you talked about this patient going off testosterone and so forth, they were worried about keeping that patient on testosterone. Well, remember, in the mitochondria, that is where the sex hormones are all the origination of the process to make these sex hormones, like testosterone and estrogen and so forth, all begins in the mitochondria from pregnenolone being converted into cholesterol. Cholesterol converting to pregnenolone. And so that's very important, because then pregnenolone then takes its various steps in multiple hormone production. That happens in the mitochondria. That happens because of efficiencies in the mitochondria. When we lose efficiencies, we lose that ability and production. And that's an important point to bring up in elderly people, because that's where we find, you know, using these GHRHs, GHRPs can be monumentally valuable without having significant rises in testosterone. You're going to do enough, by improving that mitochondrial ability to convert cholesterol pregnenolone. And that's a huge step. And again, it comes back to all of these things that we spend so much time understanding and studying in cellular medicine. So we're working on all these little root causes that over time incrementally make significant changes for these patients. So we've talked about the immune regulation, we've talked about metabolism, and you know, we could easily jump into the microbiome and talk about maybe, without even going into fully evaluating the microbiome, which you would like to do, because unfortunately with these patients, they're typically their microbiome changes and they produce less of the important short chain fatty acids like butyrate, propionate, acetate. And this is where a butyrate supplement can be significant, because butyrate, like a ketone ester, is a small chain fatty acid that is going to be utilized in the body as an energy source, and has many other applications and far-reaching aspects on metabolism and the immune system. So it's just another added part here that I think plays a great role and then can lead you down towards further evaluating the microbiome. So I know I've added, I've made this into a much bigger question answer process than maybe you were anticipating, but I wanted to use this as an example that there's so many things that are important to think about here, but I think you can make substantial changes for this patient just based on the basics of working on the immune modulation, working on senescence, working on metabolism, and improving metabolism. Hence, you've combined these into really improving immune modulation or immunometabolism. And then you've touched on a little bit on the microbiome and what and how you can have an effect without fully going into evaluating that process, but lead you down that road later, because you want to give the patient all of these positive aspects so their brain buys into this process. And that is so important. You know, the patient has to feel things are changing, things are getting better. I'm able to walk farther. I feel like I have more energy. I'm not as tired in the afternoon. I'm getting up early now. All these things where then you can start working on circadian clock aspects, all these things that make an important point here that I'm trying to make. And there's so much that goes into this, but I think that's a great beginning for you. I think it's a wonderful place for everybody to kind of look at this as a bigger question of all of those things I discussed about the microbiome, the immune system, and metabolism. So I'm so excited you asked that question. And as you hear in my voice, I could keep talking about this for another 3 or 4 hours. But this is perfect for a place for us to start and to have more discussion on our forum here. So thank you very much. I really appreciate answering that question. This is the second question. I have a new patient looking to get off of her SNRIs, which are serotonin norepinephrine receptor inhibitors, and Xanax. My pharmacy has just run out of all of their stock of Celenc. Does anyone have experience with these suggested substitutes? Which one would come closest to Celenc and in its anoxalytic actions? Thank you in advance. So this question, I think, covering this concept of anxiety is a huge task. The fact that you were using Celenc, and unfortunately, that Celenc is becoming less available, but that's another discussion where I truly believe we'll have access to the Celenc here in the future. But that being said, Celenc and its effects on BDNF and its effects on GABA-A, it's undeniable how important Celenc has been in our treatment protocols and how important it has been in working on anxiety states. So your question of the PE2228 and the synapsin, I think you asked the synapsin RGB. I think that's what it was. That has merit, but let me bring you back to some of the basics of, you know, where I think there's a far better answer here for you to utilize, where we have a lot more experience in giving you an option that maybe you haven't thought about, and that's this molecule hanokil. Remember, hanokil is an ancient Chinese herb. It comes from the Mongolia bark. It has had tremendous research over the years on its incredible anti-inflammatory, antimicrobial, antiviral, anti-anxiety. Has all of these pleiotropic, again, effects on improvement in areas of metabolism and immunity. It's really an incredible molecule, and we've had the benefit of working with this for long, well over 10 years, in the in a molecule that has been taken, hanokil has been taken and made into something called dihydrohanokil, DHHB. And that molecule is, what it was done, it was cyclized basically and made into a stronger, more potent molecule that had, you could look at it like, had a more significant potential where we could utilize it as a supplement in a 7 milligram to 30 milligram capsule that we could use to have a significant influence, and a very initial influence that you wouldn't see with just hanokil by itself. So we've had, I think, tremendous experience in using hanokil, and many clinics have used, many rehab clinics have been utilizing dihydrohanokil as a primary source in weaning off benzodiazepines and SSRIs and SNRIs and other antidepressants. So I think I can say we speak from good and great experience with this in giving you an option that that is healthy and has real influences on anxiety. And you know, when we look at anxiety, I think the focus here is what can we do to influence the GABA A receptor, and that is where the benzos are so effective. They're working on the GABA A receptor, and that's exactly where dihydrohanokil is an allosteric activator of that receptor. So it influences that receptor to a significant level where there's no tolerance problems, there are no addiction problems as you get with benzos, and it has a direct effect. And in fact, hanokil has been, there was an initial pharmacology paper done back in the 1990s that showed its direct effect on the GABA A receptor in influencing chloride transport across the cell, which is all about the GABA A agonist and how they work well. So I think just knowing that, and knowing that there's true metabolism, or there's true pathways involved in understanding this, the hanokil, dihydrogen hanokil, has been a powerful tool for us in assisting this aspect of anxiety and working with people in utilizing it. And we start off with low doses that are still out there where people are using like 7 milligrams. And we found that actually going right to 30 milligrams is a significant dosing that has even more positive effects. And the interesting thing is that we've also learned it's very difficult to, I've not seen or reached a level of where you've given somebody too much Hanokil. I haven't seen any issues with that, by the way. So in discussing this dihydrated Hanokil, I'll also give you the insight on it has this notoriety of this name given to it as the chill pill. And that actually started with a group of my patients that were all kind of like the soccer moms, the moms that were always in the car driving constantly, and their kids do all these events. And dihydrated Hanokil got this influence from one of our patients that was one of these moms. I call her the soccer mom, who influenced other moms and said, "You guys are missing it. You know, let's start enjoying these events and let's start traveling well. Let's be a group." And all of a sudden, I had all these moms on dihydrated Hanokil, and they called it. They came back to me and told me, "You know, this is an amazing chill pill." And so that's how it got its name, by the way, if you're interested. But what's important there, of what you may have picked up, is I said, these are people that are active, driving, utilizing heavy equipment, so forth. Dihydrated Hanokil has no effect. It has no sedative effect. That's crucial and important to realize. So you can function at a high level. And in fact, I think it gives people the active capability of higher intention, higher cognitive skills, higher executive skills, and no intervention with sedative effects, other than, believe it or not, it's a great tool to utilize at night. It doesn't make you tired, but it gives you the ability when you're ready to go to bed. It has that potential as a GABA agonist, GABA A agonist, to influence sleep. So that's another little nice tool here that you have with dihydrated Hanokil. I'll tell you some other areas that, you know, we've learned a lot about this supplement, and it can be used in conjunction with Selenc. It can be used in conjunction with something like PE2228, which I think is actually another choice that you can make that I think can have an influence on what you're trying to accomplish, but it's not something I'd start with. I think it's something that you can think about as a secondary measure here after that dihydrated Hanokil if you need it. It does have some impressive antidepressive aspects, and it works very quickly. It can work within the first week or two, as opposed to an SSRI that can take, you know, up to 4 to 6 weeks and can have some negative effects initially, then positive effects. So I'm not counting out the PE2228, and I think I'll get into that in another question coming up here later and focus on that in depth. But let me continue on this anxiety issue, which I think is just so important for us to realize what we see. We see out there anxiety everywhere. And this tool is a supplement that has no tolerance effects, no addictive qualities, does not affect or sedate you, and has about a 3 to 4 hour half-life, maybe a little bit longer, so you can use it multiple times a day if necessary. I think that's an incredible tool you have there. Give you a little bit more history with where I've seen these benefits, and solidifies some of the mechanisms that we think are even have been proven with these with anxiety is, you know, this issue of this higher degree of losing these what we call neurosteroids, like allopregnanolol or TDHOC, tetrahydrodeoxy. So I think it's important for us to understand some of these mechanisms of how these patients get into these states of depression and actually where we can add something else into play with the dihydrohodoquial. And why dihydrohodoquial is effective is we've gotten a better understanding of anxiety and the loss of the activity of this 5-alpha reductase enzyme that has an influence on some neurosteroids like allopregnanolol or TDHOC, which is tetrahydrodeoxycorticosteroid. Those are two very important neurosteroids that are very influential in anxiety. And in fact, they're decreased. Anybody that has anxiety to a significant degree, they have decreased levels of those two neurosteroids. And remember, these neurosteroids, they basically come from the precursor pregnenolone. And remember, this has everything to do with mitochondrial function, because in the mitochondria, the first steps of any steroid production is cholesterol to pregnenolone, and then pregnenolone through those processes. So here is an important concept where potentially a supplement like pregnenolone could be a significant player in adding in here, because we know those pregnenolone leads to an improvement in those neurosteroids and even allopregnanolone. But allopregnanolone is a prescription versus pregnenolone is a prohormone. Allopregnanolone is given IV. It's used it's used in anesthesia. It's just a prescription. It's something you're not going to be able to utilize directly. But pregnenolone's a perfect solution here in adding. Remember, we're trying to work on building foundations. So you're trying to build something back. And in fact, this has an interesting place in all of these people on things like finasteride, for hair loss. If you think about all these hair loss drugs, they're mainly focused on inhibiting 5-alpha reductase. Well, it's interesting because you see a lot of those people that are treating hair loss with finasteride, they do have issues with anxiety. So if you want to get into those issues with helping some of those people, and remember, not everybody that takes these, the 5-alpha reductase inhibitors like finasteride, they're not going to all decrease the amount of pregnenolone or allopregnenolone or the TDHOC. There are other epigenetic factors and genetic issues that are related to making somebody more vulnerable. So all I'm saying is we know some mechanisms. We know some things to be aware of. We know an enzyme that's very important, the 5-alpha reductase. And so just having that knowledge, again, what we're all focused on in cellular medicine is understanding these relationships so that we can figure things out. And I think you have two incredible tools there to start with that can be of significance with the DHHB and the pregnenolone. And that's just a simple start. We could get into a lot more, and as I said, I think the PE2228 could be absolutely something. The synapsin product, I've used that in the past, and I haven't, I have other physicians that say they they think it makes a change, an influence. I've never had much success with that. I was an early adopter when that product first became available, and it made sense, but there was never really any research behind it other than the use of it and what it was made for. And it made sense, but I just have never had the benefit of it making a significant influence. I'll tell you, there are others who've said they think it has, but I had quite a bit of experience with it. So I'm just going back to the basics of the pregnenolone and the dihydrohinokiol. I think there are just so many tremendous benefits with both of those that can, and remember, I got to bring up one other thing. I think you cannot forget about the DHEA. DHEA is very important here because it comes also from pregnenolone, and it has an influence with cortisol, and it has a significant role in anxiety. And I see it, if you go after this and start looking at these things, and you'll see that people are depleted in DHEA. And that simple addition of a small amount of DHEA and then titrating it, I think can make significant changes. And I think in females, you know, further evaluating the hormonal issues with cortisol and the DHEA, doing that through urine metabolites, you can really dial in that process, but that's a little beyond this. But yeah, I think just giving you that insight, let me back up and say, I've just used DHEA by itself and had significant influence on anxiety and somewhat of depression states, because it's another factor that's depleted because of that pregnenolone progression that I've discussed. So I think that gives you a basis of helping you understand this more, of maybe some simple things you can start with, and you may be very pleased in where you can go with this and what a significant change it can make. So glad to hear your feedback on the forum and with how you progress with this, because I think everybody can learn with us here, and it'd be exciting for us to continue to have this interaction. So thank you so much for an awesome question, and I hope I helped out there. All right, now for our last question. Hi, I am interested in any expert opinion here. I have a patient with a history of breast cancer that has been cleared, and this pertains to any patient with a history of cancer. I would like to start this patient on CJC ipamorelin for the regenerative and anti-aging benefits, the 5 nights per week dosing, and she wanted to know the risks of cancer using this peptide. From what I see, read, and understand, if there is current cancer, it can grow with this peptide. So obviously, no go. But if the history of cancer has been cleared, it should be okay as long as ongoing surveillance is done. Can you please address this? Sincerely, thanks. So as I read through Abid's answer here, I think, you know, Abid does an amazing job in clarifying how to think about this, and then the approach and the realistic aspects of this. So I'm going to read. This is a risky territory. How long has she been in remission, and what is the evidence that she's been cleared of breast cancer? The studies that look at tesamorelin in Kaposi sarcoma show regression of tumor burden, so there is evidence that these agents may be anti-carcinogenic. Tesamorelin is a different compound than CJC ipamorelin and can be extrapolated based on the studies of both here. Maybe, but the general uninformed opinion about these agents is that they all function like human growth hormone. If she has any return of cancer, the oncologists and the physicians will blame it on the use of the CJC IPA and that puts you at a substantial medical legal risk. Hope this helps. Abid. So I think Abid just really nails it down here. And this is where I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about I totally agree with what he said and the intention of his main informational, push here was to let you know, regardless of how right we are and how we focus on this process, and the amount of information we can produce to provide and back our answers in validating some of the uses of these GHRHs and GHRPs in cancer, it's still not the accepted norm because everybody's focused on this growth hormone influence on tumors. And that in itself is very controversial also. And I think you just have to be, it has to be a discussion you have with your patients in informing your patients of what the current literature says, what the current medical legal side of this is, which he well explained. And I think if you have that discussion with your patients, you can get a lot farther in making a decision with your patient. But remember, in using these GHRHs and GHRPs, the first thing I want to really emphasize is these are physiologic releases of growth hormone, which induce physiologic changes in IGF-1. We're not creating significant super physiologic levels of IGF-1 that potentially can have an influence on cancer. We're influencing a physiologic change. And that's very important, as opposed to people taking exogenous growth hormone, which is a continuous flow. Remember, growth hormone, the way it's used with these secretagogues, is pulsed. It's pulsed out anywhere from 2 to 3 up to 6 times a day, maybe a little bit more. As we're getting older, we're losing those pulses and we're losing the amplitude of those pulses. So in essence, we're not doing anything that a growth hormone would do that would cause a continuous flow that actually causes increased supraphysiologic levels of IGF-1. And guess what? An exogenous growth hormone induces premature cellular senescence. Well, what do we know about senescence? Senescence is carcinogenic. Senescence leads to oncogenic senescent processes. So there you go. I mean, that's, I think, the problem. I think too many people are relating this to exogenous growth hormone really or use and that process in itself. Now, even that's controversial, okay, in the literature. But I'm giving you the mechanisms that are very real and are true with that process. So let's back up and then look at, again, these uses of these GHRHs and GHRPs. Well, I'll tell you that tumor research started out with anti-GHRH molecules. And that was done, that is all that research has been based by a Dr. Scully out of Miami, who has done incredible work on GHRHs and anti-GHRHs and their influence on cancer. And just a few years ago, he came out with this incredible revelation that, guess what? GHRH agonists actually have anti-cancer effects. That's a tremendous statement. That's a bold statement for a gentleman who spent his whole life on anti-GHRH research and discussing this influence on cancer, where he actually proved that GHRHs are anti-cancer molecules. And if we think about it, the mechanisms, we kind of talked about this physiologic release of GHRHs and GHRPs and releasing the right amount of growth hormone. Well, what's that activity of growth hormone? What's it really doing? Remember, it's improving AMPK. AMPK. Well, what happens in tumors? What happens with cancer? It's the balance of AMPK and mTOR. And tumors are mTOR dominant. If you're influencing AMPK, AMPK is going to have a direct effect on the activation of mTOR. And that's kind of the beginning of where you have to start, why this makes so much sense in understanding cellular medicine and why we look at all of these little factors. And it's the details, it's the devil in the detail that make these decisions for all of us much easier to have discussions with our patients, because we've got the support, we've got the literature, we know the process, and you can have really great discussions on making decisions like this to move forward. So that AMPK mTOR thing is huge, because what in cancer right now, everything's focused on decreasing mTOR. And so a lot of things are. So I give you that to think about in understanding where we are with these GHRHs and GHRPs. And again, GHRPs have the same influence on AMPK, and even potentially a more profound effect on AMPK. And we kind of categorize that also in that process. And I'll also tell you that there have been multiple cancer studies on using GHRP mimetics or GHRP peptides in post-cancer states for patients in cachectic states, right? Because cancer leads to malnutrition, leads to sarcopenia. Well, they've used these GHRPs in influencing the improvement in the sarcopenia, in the improvement of nutrition, because remember, the pleiotropic effect of a GHRP is to increase hunger for some patients, depending on the type of GHRP, which is very important in a cachectic cancerous patient, but also in improving the protein absorption in the gut with the growth hormone release. And guess what? In those studies of those patients that had various types of breast cancer, liver cancer, lung cancer, so forth, there were no recurrences. There were no, and that's tens of thousands of patients. That in itself gives you, I think, some information that's very valuable. We have some of these discussions in our mastermind, in our cancer mastermind, and we still will continue to talk more about this. I think it's just an excellent question to bring up. I think it's an excellent response from Abid, and I fully support what he said and just added that little bit of understanding of why in cellular medicine we are focused on having better discussions with our patients. And that's what it comes down to. Isn't medicine all about the art of treating a patient? Isn't it all about informing your patient? Isn't it all about the discussion you can have that I think patients can help you make better decisions also? And of course, you know, you document all these things that you discuss. So I hope that helps. I think it was just a great thing to bring up on the discussion board, and I look forward to more of these questions. I look forward to more interaction with all of you. This is exciting, and this gets me thinking. It gets me thinking about other things that I need to focus on and be more better at explaining. So thank you all for hanging in there with me, and have a great day. Today's episode was produced and engineered by Drew Schaefer of Drew Schaefer Studio in conjunction with the SSRP Institute. Thanks also to the SSRP community and our entire team. Please make sure to subscribe. Thank you for listening to the Cellular Medicine Podcast from the SSRP Institute. To learn more, visit ssrpinstitute.org.